This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next speaker is Dr. Melissa Troster. She's at the Department of Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. Sorry, UNC.
Melissa.
And she's also the PI of one of the Windows of Susceptibility programs here in the BSER. So thank you, Melissa.
Sure.
Okay,
thanks. So a lot of the background that I'm about to present is actually work that's come from Pepper Shadeen and Ginger Borges' lab. So it's a pleasure to speak in this section on pregnancy and then also to precede Dr. Russo, who will present the other side of the story. So I'm going to talk about sort of the stromal side or all of that connective tissue that surrounds epithelium and how that influences our ideas about how breast cancer might be developing and also helps us to formulate hypotheses about specific windows of susceptibility. And then I'm also going to talk about a particular environmental exposure, which is obesity, and how that might be interacting with these changes that are happening in the course of the lifespan. And then I'm going to focus in a little bit on basal-like breast cancer, which is a particular subtype of breast cancer, which we think has unique associations with both pregnancy and obesity. So this is a different variation on the curves that you just saw, showing that pregnancy-associated breast cancer is something that happens in the first few years following a pregnancy. And what you see here is a line, a dashed line at 1, which shows us the risk in nulliparous women of breast cancer. And then there's a period of time before 10 years where women have an elevated risk of breast cancer following a delivery. And it takes about 7 to 10 years to cross over, and it varies depending on age. But at some point, a lifetime risk of breast cancer is reduced due to a pregnancy. The underlying explanation for why that lifetime reduction in risk occurs focuses largely on changes that happen in the epithelial cells. So those cells undergo changes that cause the cells to have very different behavior and very different morphology and appearance, and this can be readily examined in mouse tissue and also, as Dr. Borges was just showing, is also evident in human tissue, but in much greater variation in humans. So one of the things you're going to hear a lot from me today is about how humans are just much more heterogeneous and that we all behave very uniquely, and this poses a challenge for us as scientists when we're trying to develop public health messages because we have quite a bit of variation in human populations, and so it's very hard to predict individual risk. And it's also particularly hard to communicate about these issues when we have complicated messages such as pregnancy does one thing for a period of time and then another thing at a different period of time. And so in speaking with some of the advocates here today, I just wanted to encourage you to help us to think about how to best communicate these scientific concepts, which tend to be complicated, but are nonetheless, you know, fundamental to helping us develop these public health messages. So what we observe is that, going back to this figure, there's this period of elevated risk. And here, this is work from Pepper Shadeen and Dr. Borges that showed that, you know, there's this massive influx of immune cells that occurs in involuting mammary gland. And you can see there those black dots in the involuting areas, which represent macrophages. And this is a very stimulating environment. It produces a lot of different proteins and cytokines that the epithelial cells respond to by proliferating and other sorts of wound responses and migration responses, things that we think of as being bad for cancer progression. So when we look at this from a biological perspective, we take what is largely an epidemiologic set of data, and that tells us about the curves and what's happening at the population level. And what our goal is to try to probe that deeper on a biological level and start to try to understand what are the mechanisms that are driving each portion of that curve. So there might be a period at the beginning of this time after delivery where we can think of the stroma and all those immune cells and other stromal components as being dominant. And then another portion later on after a woman has given birth where the epithelium becomes dominant and is driving the major associations with risk. But there are two problems with this model that we identified as needing further research. One of those is the fact that breast cancer is not a single disease. Basal-like breast cancer is associated with increased parity. So what we see with basal-like breast cancer does not mimic this overall curve. We see that breast cancer risk goes up and stays up. The other problem is that there are a lot of things that change in a woman's life when she has a child. It's not just this stromal response, but there's lots of lifestyle factors and environmental exposures that change. And so one of the things that we've noted is that obesity increases very much in Paris women compared to nulliparous women. So here you can see average rates of obesity are about 11.3% in Paris women and only 4.5% in nulliparous women. And this also depends on race. And because African-American women are particularly susceptible to basal-like breast cancer, we think this is an important factor to research further. And I also point out that I'm from North Carolina, which is not one of the blue states on that map. We have a much higher percentage of obesity in... we're not blue in a number of different ways, but... We almost were blue, but the central hypothesis that we wanted to investigate with our research was this idea that parity and the postpartum period represent a window of susceptibility for environmental obesity, and that by studying this period, we might learn some things about pathways and environmental exposures that could be modified during that period and change a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer. So we've taken three different approaches in my research group. The first is we've been looking at basal-like microenvironments. So what we want to understand is how does a basal-like cancer cell interact with the cells around it, and how might that change its behavior? The second is that we've looked at basal-like microenvironments in specific mouse models that are designed to study this most aggressive type of breast cancer. Basal-like breast cancers are the triple-negative breast cancers that tend to have very poor survival, especially in the first few years after diagnosis. And so we're trying to study specifically what are the biological patterns that happen in a mouse model. And there we can actually manipulate diet and try to understand how high-fat diet influences breast cancer risk in the specific subtype. And then finally, we're trying to integrate all this in terms of what happens in human beings and looking at obese and postpartum microenvironments in human tissue. So I'm going to start by telling you about our in vitro studies with basal-like breast cancer cells interacting with the surrounding stroma. So here you see a cluster diagram, and what we do here is we do gene expression microarrays, which enable us to look at thousands of genes at a time. And if you look down the columns here, each column represents a separate experiment where we've basically taken epithelial cells, which are represented in blue here, and put them together with fibroblasts. And we allow these cells to get into communication and communicate back and forth via soluble factors. And then by running gene expression microarrays, we can measure how the gene expression of many different genes changes at a given point in time. And we can look at, are there specific changes that tend to occur in luminal breast cancers that don't occur in basal breast cancers and vice versa? So what you see here is what we call a heat map. And on the right-hand side at the top is this dendrogram that tells you how related the different samples are. So you see cell lines like MCF7, ZR75, and T47D. Those are luminal breast cancers. They're ER positive. They tend to be your better prognosis breast cancers. And they have a very distinct pattern of interaction with their surrounding stroma. The cells on the left in the hot colors are the basal-like breast cancers, and they have a very distinct pattern. And the pattern that seems to be more common in basal-like breast cancers are a lot of pro-inflammatory genes, cytokines and things like that, that help cells to become more migratory. So what we did then after finding this in vitro is we asked the question, well, if this is true in a single model system, in a cell culture system, it should be observable in tumors. So we wanted to link it back to in vivo. And the interesting thing that we found is that here you can see a test set of human samples, and the blue samples are luminal breast cancers, and the red samples are basal-like breast cancers. And PAM50 is our gold standard method of distinguishing these two. So the gold standard result as to which type these tumors are is shown in that first line. In the second line, we took a gene signature that came from the cellular communication state of these cells. So we basically looked at how they were talking to one another, and we used that to classify the cells as either being luminal or basal. And we did pretty well. But what was most interesting is that just looking at the fibroblast component alone, not even looking at what the epithelial cells are making, we can really highly accurately predict whether there is a basal-like or a luminal breast cancer in the presence of that fibroblast. So those responses seem very stereotyped. And this is interesting because in the past, we've tended to primarily focus on epithelial cells when we want to understand breast tumor behavior. Epithelial cells are the most abundant cell. They're the cell that undergoes the mutation. But they're not in a vacuum. So there's a lot of interesting things that can be learned by studying that surrounding tissue. And that surrounding tissue has a very basal-like specific specific response. So using a similar cell line model as Dr. Borges had mentioned, where we looked at ductal carcinoma in situ models, we wanted to look at when do these cells start to acquire this phenotype. So we compared normal MCF10A cells, which were cells that came from a woman who just had a fibrocystic disease. She'd had a biopsy for her lesion, which turned out to be benign. So those were developed into a cell line and passaged over time until they eventually formed a cell type that has the same genetics background but can form an atypical hyperplasia. So it's beginning to get a little bit stranger. And then ultimately, this cell line was passaged long enough that it became capable of forming a ductal carcinoma in situ. And so we compared how does this cell type differentially interact with fibroblasts. And what you can see here is that depending on how progressed, how far along in the etiologic process these cells have moved, they have very different patterns of expression. You can see different sort of regions of color in each of these columns. So we looked at our basal-like score that we had developed previously, and here on the right you see a curve which shows you that the MCF7, which is the luminal cell, has a negative interaction score. So it's having none of this character that we see as being this basal-like character. The SUM149 is a clearly basal-like line, and it has a high degree of this basal-like character. In the premalignant lines, what you see is that they start out as having very low basal-like character, but as soon as they get to that DCIS stage, you see an increase in the expression of that character so that they start to really look like invasive cell lines. So this is showing us that early in the process of progression, these cells start to change their interactions with the surrounding tissue. So we were interested in what were the exact mediators of this. It's interesting to see this on a gene expression pattern basis, but we want to know exactly what are the signals that are being received here. So we performed some protein assays where we basically looked at the proteins that these cells were secreting into the media. And what you see here is cytokine array data where you notice that there's one bar that's really sticking up, and this is hepatocyte growth factor. Hepatocytes are cells in the liver, and in the 80s it was discovered that the hepatocyte growth factor was a really important mediator in liver growth. But the role in breast cancer has emerged more slowly over time, and there's quite a bit of literature, actually, that hepatocyte growth factor is important in breast development as well, despite the name. So what we see here is that hepatocyte growth factor expression is very high in these ductal carcinoma in situ cells, and that when you look at the receptor, the site on the epithelial cells that detects that HGF, it is highly expressed in the DCIS cells, but not in the atypical hyperplasia or in the normal cells. So it seems like you have to have both. You have to have both the cytokine and its receptor to get the biological activity. And it looks like you don't get both until the DCIS stage in this model system. And this was true both on the RNA level and on the protein level. So we always like to see evidence of both changing in order to know that the RNA changes are really manifest as function. So then to try to link that with some kind of cell-based phenotype or something that was happening beyond the signaling level, we looked at morphogenesis assays. So the way that the breast forms in the body is it's actually very interesting. The breast doesn't make just as many cells as it needs. It makes more cells than it needs, and then it kills off the cells in the middle. So when you think about the breast cells as being a balloon, what happens is the breast kind of fills up that whole balloon totally with cells. And then the cells in the middle sort of undergo a cell death process to leave just cells lining the outsides of the duct. And that's the normal process of morphogenesis. And that's what we're measuring here in a 3D assay. And so what we looked at was how far progressed in this process of morphogenesis were these different cell lines. And you can see in the left panel here that when there's no lumen, this is here, looking at this part, there's no lumen, you see more of the normal cells, the MCF10A cells that have no lumen. And then in the DCIS, there's fewer that have no lumen because they've progressed to this side of the curve where they're actually more progressed. And this is often used as a marker of invasive potential. What this tells us is that these cells are undergoing proliferation, motility, all sorts of different changes that make them capable of being invasive and capable of forming the ductal structures that make up the breast. After finding this HGF factor was important, and that what we were able to do was then treat the cells with this antibody to HGF, essentially pulling it out of the media, and we were able to revert the phenotype. So we were able to take a cell that was more DCIS-like or showing more of that basal-like character of being morphogenically advanced and push it back towards a more normal state. So we were very excited about that. And we also wanted to know, well, if this is really important in basal-like breast cancer, it shouldn't just be in the premalignant cells, it should also be in the tumors. So we took a large database of breast tumors, and we looked at whether HGF-related changes were being expressed. And what you can see here is about 90% of these basal-like tumors have high levels of HGF expression and express a whole pattern of genes that's associated with expression of HGF, whereas only a few luminals, only about 20 to 25% of luminals have this. So it's a very strong marker of breast cancer subtype. And in an emerging line of research, we're also finding that HGF is regulating important biological characteristics of the cancers. Specifically, the cancer cells need to fuel their growth somehow, and the way they do that is by absorbing glucose. And GLUT1 is the major transporter on the cell. It's one of the major transporters on the surface of the cell that imports glucose and brings it in. And what we see here is that in all of these cell lines, at the top you see GLUT1, and this is a Western blot that measures this protein, which kind of runs as a smear because there's lots of glycosylation, so it tends to run as a smear. But what you can see is when you grow these basal-like cells with the fibroblasts, they spike their HGF, and then they spike this GLUT1 receptor. And we can reverse that glucose transporter expression by adding this HGF. So the possibility is that anti-HGF inhibitors, and there's a number of receptor antagonists that can block HGF signaling, could actually cut these cells off from their fuel supply and make it harder for them to continue to fuel their proliferation and their motility. So these are interesting findings, but they're all in vitro and they're with cell lines, and so we think it's important to have multiple different approaches to try to understand the problem from different perspectives. So my collaborator Liza Makowski at UNC has been working on basal-like microenvironments in mice using this special model called the C3 tag. And here's a picture of what happens to tumor latency. So this is the amount of time it takes for a tumor to develop. So when the mice are on regular diet, 10% fat, they have about a 19-week latency. But when you put them on a higher fat diet, the amount of time it takes for them to get a tumor is decreased. So these mice on the higher fat diet get tumors about 2 weeks earlier. So this is a suggestion that this high-fat diet is playing a role in the etiology of the disease. What we don't know is whether these animals have to get obese or if it's just the diet alone that does that for them. And that's something that we're working with some of the Michigan State researchers to try to investigate more fully. But at this point in time, what we do know is that there's a change when you have high-fat diet in the presence of obesity. Interestingly, a corresponding change happens in HGF. So this gene that I was telling you about that we found in the basal-like microenvironments goes up as you have increasing levels of fat in the diet. So at a 60% diet, we have high levels of HGF expression. Here we're looking at where it's expressed in the tissue, and you can see that HGF is expressed more highly in the 60% diet, and it's coming from the stroma, and that the receptor for HGF, c-MET, is being expressed in the epithelium, and again, it's highest in that 60% diet. So we're looking at a pathway that's subtype-specific and that appears to be modulated by an environmental factor, which is a high-fat diet in the presence of obesity. Okay, so all of that is interesting. Again, model systems. And ultimately, we want to understand more about human breast cancer. So I told you I was going to talk about some of the variation we see in humans. And what we've been studying with human tissue is how obesity and parity affect the tissue itself. This is a picture from a Purio scanning where we have a 50-year-old African-American woman. This is histology of her breast tissue. There's some details here about the type of cancer she had, but this is a low BMI woman. And what you see is that the tissue is mostly stroma and adipose, but there's 7% epithelium. It doesn't sound like very much. That's actually pretty average for the human population, about 5 to 10% epithelial content. But what's striking is when I go from this picture to this picture, you can see that this is a very different looking breast tissue. This is an older woman, and the epithelium has almost all but disappeared. There's a lot less fat, and it's a very stromal-rich tissue. And this is some of the types of variation that we see in the human population. We see very distinct differences in the stromal composition, and we think that this might be important and that this might tell us something about who's at risk for breast cancer. So what we're thinking about in these models is trying to understand composition and try to put it within a context of a window of susceptibility. So we talked about this idea that there's this window of susceptibility following pregnancy, and this shows this life course approach, that early in life you get immune cell infiltration as your body develops breast tissue. And then later in life, after a pregnancy, there's another influx period where there's lots of immune cells coming in, and then they hopefully would go back down again. And this has been supported by the work from Dr. Borges' lab. But what we wanted to know was, how well does that stromal signature of immune response resolve? So you've seen some evidence that the epithelial tissue really resolves. But we're looking here at people regardless of the length of time since pregnancy. So we did gene expression signatures to compare Paris and nulliparous women. And you can see that there's a very distinct gene expression profile from Paris and nulliparous, but that human beings are not quite so orderly, and we get all sorts of misclassification here. So we tend to have nulliparous people that look like Paris people and Paris people that look like nulliparous, and this is important because it helps us to understand why people are so unpredictable. We have a very hard time predicting who is going to get a response from a particular risk factor. So this is our data showing obesity also produces similar changes. So we see lots of immune changes that occur when a woman is obese versus non-obese. And all of these point to specific pathways relating to macrophages. So I told you that macrophages are important in the period following pregnancy. We also see that obesity causes an increase in macrophage content in obese tissue. So here you see macrophage counts greater than 5 were higher in obese compared to non-obese, and that inflammation loci or crown-like structures were also high in obesity. So this has caused us to sort of think about another model. In addition to thinking about that stromal change that occurs during the postpartum period, we think that obesity might cause either a sustained infiltration or a higher magnitude infiltration. So we're trying to use that windows of susceptibility context, but then figure out how might an environmental exposure like obesity alter that window and create either a longer window or a window that has a different character in some way. So all these three different types of approaches are helping us to get a picture on some of the mechanisms and some of the ways in which basal-like breast cancer might be influenced by the presence of high-fat diet and obesity. And as we're going through this work, I wanted to acknowledge the importance of our collaboration with our community partners, Nisha Graves and Kathleen Gray, who both have, you know, really helped us to clarify our messages and have done a lot to help us understand how to communicate these complicated concepts, and who are helping us to develop communication tools. There are also a number of collaborators at other institutions who have donated tissue for our studies and who have been extremely helpful, and I especially wanted to acknowledge NIEHS and NCI for the funding support and also support from Avon Foundation for our work. And these are the people who've done a lot of the work in the lab as well, so thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.